This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Claire Nichols, and welcome to The Book Show, where today we explore forgotten histories. The Cuban writer Armando Lucas Correa is fascinated by moments in time that many would rather forget. His two novels explore incidents in World War II that have been, for the most part, kept in the dark. My first guest has done something similar too. Tony Burch's new novel explores the ongoing trauma of Australia's very recent colonial past. He's here in a moment, here on The Book Show. Every once in a while, you meet a literary hero who you immediately fall in love with. And for me, that happened a couple of weeks ago when I met Odette Brown, the loving and resilient grandmother at the centre of Tony Burch's new novel, The White Girl. Odette is an Aboriginal woman caring for her young granddaughter Sissy in a fictional Australian town in 1960s Australia. But how does she keep her granddaughter safe when a new policeman arrives in town determined to remove Sissy from Odette's care? Tony Burch, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tony, at its heart, this is really a story about the stolen generations. You've said that you've never met an Aboriginal person who doesn't have a story of loss through this period. How much are these losses continuing to shape the people that you speak to?
Oh, look, they shape Aboriginal people in very fundamental ways, both in ways of tragedy and ongoing trauma, so that I know so many Aboriginal people who in generations past or even in the current generation have lost or been separated from a family member, and sometimes they've never been reunited with that person, and that person has been lost to family and community. But of course, as is the case with Odette Brown, the fictional grandmother in this story, the same people have enormous capacity for resilience and strength, and they use that strength to continue to keep families together and to fight for justice around notions of, you know, the removal of children from family. So it's an ongoing issue which both harms and strengthens community at the same time.
Yeah. And this book is just, the timing of this book is so recent. We're in this fictional Australian town. The year is 1963. So we're 4 years away from the referendum. The mission in the town is closed, but Aboriginal people are still living in fear of their children or grandchildren being taken away by authorities. Can you just help me, Tony, just explain what life was like in this particular period of time in the 60s for Aboriginal people?
Well, it's quite complex because, as you just stated, it's moving towards the 1967 referendum, and people know that that referendum was very successful in the sense that it was supported by overwhelmingly by most Australians. But for Aboriginal people living in many states in Australia, so certainly the southern states right through to southern Queensland and in certainly in Western Australia where you are today, Aboriginal people would live under various forms of what are called Aborigines Acts. So depending on what state you were in, depending on what time it was, that the restrictions applied to those acts could mean, for instance, in the case of Odette Brown, that where she lived would be determined by the act, who she lived with would be determined by the act, where she worked, who she married, what children could be in her care. Her life was governed by the Aborigines Act, which placed enormous restrictions on her. And in Odette's case, and in the case of real-life Aboriginal people, that came with the constant threat of the removal of children from family, which of course happened to many tens of thousands of people. The other issue that I wanted to highlight in the novel is that it's not only complex, it's incredibly contradictory and unpredictable. In this case, in the country town, you have an older policeman, Bill Shea, who's been the town policeman for a long time, and you have this new, very officious policeman, Sergeant Lowe, come to town. The way that those two policemen, in a sense, legislate the act, or in Bill's case, who fails to legislate the act, it has a real impact on the day-to-day lives of Aboriginal people, which creates that enormous sense of uncertainty, unpredictability, and great anxiety.
Because things can change in a moment, just with a change of police officer. Yeah, so Odette is this wonderful woman. She's raising her granddaughter, Sissy. She's doing everything she can to keep her safe and happy. And she has been able to keep Sissy under the radar. Is that purely because of the fact that they had this kind of incompetent copper in the town?
Well, it can be. It's interesting, that issue of what you might call summary justice at the local level. I've done a lot of work on this when I worked as a historian, and it could be because of incompetent policemen. It could be because of a genuinely benevolent policeman. Could be because of really an absence of law. So it would depend on, you're right, who was the local copper and how what their relationships with people was like. But it's quite contradictory also in another sense, so that where we are today, or where I am in Victoria, the Aborigines Welfare Board in the post-war period sometimes didn't meet for more than once or twice a year. So during the post-war period in Victoria, Aboriginal people at times were given relative freedom, and then when you saw a new administration come in, or when you recognise a change of policy, again, the old law could be readministered in a very draconian way. And the other issue, which is really frightening, it's related to what we might call behaviour and deference. So as an Aboriginal person, if you stood up for yourself and you stood up for the rights of Aboriginal people, the rights of your family, and brought yourself to the attention of a local policeman or politician because of that, well, then the law that is, you know, behind those police and politicians could be applied to you very quickly and in a very regressive way. So it was a way of also attempting to control the behaviour of Aboriginal people to remain sort of, to remain passive in a sense.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Odette says she's never really understood any other way except to remain passive, because she's grown up in the mission. She's been taking orders and she's been asking for permission her whole life.
Absolutely. And for Odette, she's, as we know, she's an incredibly strong and resilient woman, but she also, one, she knows her limitations, and she knows, unfortunately, that there are times when she has to hold her tongue and times when she can speak out. So there's a moment in the novel, quite purposely, when Bill Shea, the older policeman, comes to her house and she berates him quite severely, knowing that in that private conversation, and Bill being someone she's known since her shared childhood, she has a right, or she feels the courage to do that. She would never have done that in public. So she would certainly not do that if Bill Shea was standing with another policeman or in the street, so that she knows when and where she can stand up to someone like Shea.
So Sissy is the granddaughter, and she's also the white girl of the title of this book. Her mother, so Odette's daughter, we understand that she was probably assaulted by a white man, and that's how she gave birth to this girl. Where is Sissy's mother, Lila, now?
Within the novel, the issue is that for Lila, the point that we have to understand is a great sense of shame that she feels herself. So that when she herself abandons the town, it's not so much of abandoning her daughter, it's about her inability to deal with her own sense of shame and her dishonesty with her mother. And that notion of where is she now and where is she throughout the novel and after the novel, she's one of those very tragic women who suffers great trauma, not only herself as a teenager, but in that period of being separated from her daughter. And while we know that many, many Aboriginal people strive their whole lives to find children who have been lost and sometimes reunited or able to reunite children with family, in the case of Sissy's mother, I wanted to also highlight for some women, the tragedy and trauma is so great that it breaks them. So she's a woman who becomes totally broken by her own experience, and it debilitates her completely. And that's both understandable and an indictment on white Australia, because this is, again, one of the ongoing issues of the violence against Aboriginal children, is the generational impact on Aboriginal people, men and women and children, that it can really destroy people.
And it leaves Odette, the grandmother, feeling that she has to be everything to this girl, Sissy, give her all that love that she needs. We talked about the fact that a new police officer arrives in town, Sergeant Lowe. And he takes his role as guardian of Aboriginal children very seriously. He puts Odette and Sissy at risk. Now, I, Tony, don't think that this man is motivated by a care or concern for these children. Can you tell me what drives a man like Sergeant Lowe?
Yeah. Now, again, just to sort of preempt the fictional Lowe, one of the distressing issues of doing work on this history, over the years I'd read a lot of archival material. So reading archival material where Aboriginal women, and I know two particular Aboriginal women in Victoria, who literally wrote to the Chief Secretary of Victoria asking for the return of a daughter for 20 years. And in those heart-rending letters, you sense the great emotional difficulty those women are going through. And one of the issues that is distressing is that you get letters sent back from policemen who in some ways are like Sergeant Lowe, who write back with incredible heartlessness, that with no, they understand the trauma the women are going through, they recognise the trauma, and then talk about how the law will be applied to ensure that those women will never see their children again. So that heartlessness is real, and it's more widespread than some people would know. In the case of the fictional character Lowe, there are two issues driving him. One is that we do know that the referendum's coming up, and we do know that this may grant rights to Aboriginal people or greater rights. There are people who don't want that to happen because it will undermine their own authority, and that's what's driving him at one level. But the second level, at the level of the individual, he is quite a pathological figure. So Lowe internally is a person who literally sees his role not only as a policeman but as a man, as a human, that his authority over people is paramount. And in the way that he wishes to punish Odette, and he certainly wishes to punish other people in the town, is with a quite brutal psychological authority. And that was quite purposeful. He's not a nuanced character, and that was deliberate. I do wanted to show the potential malevolence of how legislation is carried out through an individual who, in a sense, becomes the personification of violence in both the legislation and in this story.
Yeah, he's a pretty terrifying character. But I probably should make it clear, Tony, that this is not a book where all white people are bad or evil.
Oh, well, again, there's a really important issue around this book. So Odette has a remarkable relationship with several people, particularly Henry Lamb, who is another childhood friend, who's a white man in the town, who since childhood has grown up in a junkyard and comes to run that junkyard. There's a really tender moment in the book where they part for what will be the final time, and Odette hugs Henry. They're both in their early 60s, and she says or thinks that she has never been touched by a white man before, not voluntarily, which there's a hint there of what other relationships she may have had, but there is a real love and tenderness between her and Henry. The other issue with Henry Lamb, although some people might call him today intellectually challenged, I think he has the greatest emotional intelligence of any character in the novel. So when he recognises injustices against Odette, he talks of it, and he can't actually understand it because to him that undermines the value of a fellow human being. Secondly, there's an important relationship, although more briefly, with a Jewish doctor, Dr. Singer. And there's a scene in the novel where I also wanted to convey that when Odette goes to visit the doctor and has to remove her dress to be examined, she, of course, has had very difficult relationships with authorities, including doctors, before that. And in that scene and in the subsequent scenes with Dr. Singer, again, he conveys great respect towards Odette and treats her with enormous dignity. So in that relationship, I wanted to show that she is surprised by that, but again, the potential to have wonderful or certainly dignified and equitable relationships with people is possible. So that's important. And again, in the novel, there are moments where she briefly engages with non-Aboriginal people. Some of those are difficult interventions, and some of them are quite pleasant. So it's certainly a novel which I certainly hope people, when they finish the novel, see certainly the terrors or understand the terrors of Aboriginal people living through this period. But of course, as you say, they also recognise the value of relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, which were beneficial to both.
For me, this book is really a celebration of pure love between a grandmother and her granddaughter. How much was this, Tony, about writing a book about strong black women?
Well, to be honest, it was everything. Before I'd written a word, I was it was clear that I wanted to write a book which celebrated the strength of Aboriginal women, you know, generationally, so that this is something that I've known in my own life, that I've certainly known with many women, and Odette Brown was certainly going to epitomise that strength and love. Also, I think importantly, in the relationship between her and Sissy, although Sissy is largely very protected by her grandmother, through the novel she becomes wiser and understands what's happening, and the potential for violence is something that she becomes more aware of. Essentially, though, I think that what the novel is about, it's for readers, is to say, here is this wonderful relationship between a grandmother and granddaughter, and these are the sorts of relationships that are so vital, not only to our Aboriginal communities, I think it should be vital to all communities, and that the love that you talk about is so central to the novel, so that even though we know that there is violence that has occurred in this novel, most of that is off screen, it's inferred. The tenderness between Odette and Sissy, and certainly between Odette, there's a moment with another Aboriginal woman called Wanda. The tenderness is something that I wanted to have front and centre on screen. So, yeah, there's the first, what I call the first bath scene, where Sissy has a bath and Odette washes her granddaughter's hair. I spent a lot of time on that scene because I wanted it to be explicitly about love, explicitly about tenderness, explicitly about intimate touch, and there is not a hint of violence in that scene, so that closeness between the grandmother and granddaughter was probably the most enjoyable scene I've ever written.
It's a beautiful scene, and I should mention that bath is on the cover of your book. Tony, the book is called The White Girl. I really loved this one and it stayed with me. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And Tony Burch's The White Girl is published by University of Queensland Press.
You're listening to Claire Nichols and The Book Show, available anywhere, anytime. Subscribe to the program via your favourite podcast app or listen via the ABC Listen app.
Now, later in the show, we're going to talk about queer young adult fiction with a couple of rising stars in the field. But first, here's the arts news. Virginia Woolf once said that in order for a woman to write, she needed a room of one's own and money, about £500 a year. 90 years later, the Royal Society of Literature in the UK has conducted a survey to find out how many authors make that sort of money today. They say that £500 a year in 1928 is the equivalent of about £30,000 or about 55,000 Australian dollars today. And the survey found that just 5% of UK authors make that wage each year, which is a pretty grim finding. Now, we've discussed the average earnings for Australian authors on the show before. A 2015 report by Macquarie University found that most Australian authors earn only $12,900 a year from their writing. A tree with special literary significance has fallen in America. The tree was a Monterey cypress that stood alone in the Ellen Browning Scripps Park in San Diego and apparently inspired one Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss. The author and illustrator could apparently see the tree from his home, and it served as a prototype for the famous brightly covered truffula trees that are pulled down in his 1971 book, The Lorax.
But those truffula trees! All my life I'd been searching for trees such as these. The touch of their tufts was much softer than silk, and they had the sweet smell of fresh butterfly milk.
You might remember that in The Lorax, the truffula trees are cut down by the Wunsler family to make thneeds, a knitted item that can be a sock, it's a glove, it's a hat, but it has other uses, yes, far beyond that. Now, there's no word if this tree will be turned into a thneed, but the good news is a new tree will be planted in its place. Some awards news now, and the South Australian writer Alex Cothran has won the Peter Carey Short Story Prize for 2019. This competition is run by the Moorabool Shire Council in Victoria and is open to all Australian residents for stories between 2,000 and 3,000 words. And look, it's a small prize, but I mention it because Alex's winning story, Let's Talk Trojan B, sounds really fascinating. It's made up entirely of quotes taken from Twitter, the New York Times and other news sources, as well as reports from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And according to Judge Nick Lowe, quote, Alex tells a tale of climate change and the impact of collapsing bee populations, but the frame quickly expands to encompass migrant workers, border control, far-right conspiracy theories, mass shootings, and ultimately civil war. It's ingenious, timely, and politically and socially astute. End quote. Alex Cothran takes home $1,000 in prize money, and his story will be published in an upcoming issue of Meanjin. Congratulations to Alex and to the crime writer Adrian McKinty, who has already sold the film rights for his upcoming novel, The Chain, to Paramount Pictures. Adrian was born in Belfast and was based here in Australia before relocating to New York. And in his book, a woman's daughter is kidnapped, and she's told the only way to free the teenager is to pay a ransom and kidnap someone else. Now, I'll actually be reading this one myself because Adrian McKinty will be joining me here on The Book Show in a few weeks. Finally, in arts news, what happens when you remove library late fees? Last year, the Tasmanian government scrapped late fees in a bid to encourage greater uptake of library services. And the good news is it seems to have worked. Here's Liz Jack from Libraries Australia speaking to the ABC.
We've seen an increase of 8,215 members at our libraries, and while that's significant in itself, when you compare it to the decrease of 935 members that we had in the same period of time the previous year, I think that speaks for itself.
Tasmania is the first state in the country to abolish late library return fees. And while the Australian Library and Information Association is apparently keeping a close eye on what's happening there, it has stopped short of endorsing the fee-free model. And of course, there are drawbacks to the abolition of late fees. When books are kept out for longer, they're not available to other borrowers, including those on waitlists for popular books. So I'd love to know what you think. Do library fees serve a useful purpose? Email me at artsonrn@abc.net.au. This is The Book Show, where we're about to take a dangerous journey to wartime France. In 1939, a Jewish woman and her two small daughters flee Germany. The eldest child boards a ship to Cuba, while the mother, Amanda, and her remaining daughter, Lena, head for France. The pair hope life in a small French village might offer them safety. But as the Nazis make their way across Europe, their place of refuge becomes a site of terrible atrocity. That's the setup for Armando Lucas Correa's latest novel, The Daughter's Tale. Armando is a Cuban-American writer, and this is his second novel to tell a World War II story after his 2016 hit, The German Girl. Armando Lucas Correa, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here with you.
Now, your first novel, The German Girl, was inspired by the true story of a ship called the St. Louis. And in your new book, The Daughter's Tale, we see that same ship leave Germany bound for Cuba. Can you just remind us of the details of this story of the St. Louis?
Yes, the St. Louis, it was an ocean liner for the HAPAC, a big company, German company, that ignited in 39, exactly May 13 at 8 p.m., they left Hamburg, Germany, with over 900 Jewish refugees. All of them, this is 1939, all of them, they have permit of disembark in Cuba. They pay a fortune to get them. And when they arrive in Havana on May 27 at 8 a.m. in the morning, They denied, you know, the government at that moment, the president of Cuba denied the entrance of all the passengers. Only 28 disembarked. And the government required another $500 per passenger after a big negotiation during a week between the committee helping all the Jews in New York. The Cuban government ordered that they had to leave Havana June 2nd at 8 a.m. They tried to get permit of disembark in Miami, but President Roosevelt denied the entrance to. They try again in Canada, and Prime Minister McKinsey said no to them. When they were in the middle of the ocean coming back to Germany, they got a permit of disembark in Belgium, France, Holland, and Great Britain. As you know, in September, the war started, and most of them ended in Auschwitz. And, you know, around a couple of hundred survived, most of them the children of the St. Louis. The first time that I heard this story, because I am not Jewish, you know, my family is not belong to the Holocaust, or is part of the Holocaust. But my grandmother, for my mother's side, she was pregnant with my mother when the boat arrived in Havana. And I grew up during the 70s and 80s in Cuba, listening my grandmother saying during dinner that Cuba is going to pay very dearly for the next 100 years because what they did to the Jewish refugees. I grew up with this story and became a kind of obsessed, I think.
And how does it make you feel as a Cuban? Is there some sort of sense of guilt or sadness?
It's guilt and shame at the same time. And in Cuba, you know, nobody talk about the St. Louis. Well, in every place, because I, to have an idea, it was in 2008 when President Obama invited some of the survivors of the St. Louis to the Congress, and he did like kind of apology. And it was last year, and I helped the office of the Prime Minister in Canada to invite all, you know, some of the survivors who live in the States, and he did an apology in the House of Commons. In Cuba, we're still waiting. I remember when I went to college, I had access to the National Archive, and I asked to the librarian, you know, she has been working there for 40 years, and I said, if they have something related to the St. Louis, and she said, whispering, that we used to have like a couple of boxes labeled with the St. Louis, but all of them disappeared in the 1970s. And I had the opportunity to come back to Cuba 2 years ago, and with the intention to donate most of the document that I had of the San Luis original document, pictures, postcard, the diary from the captain signed by him, and 100 books of the German girl. And all of the book was banked for the costume when we arrived with the American delegation there. I donated the document, and I left the country the next day. Even today, the St. Louis is something like, is not allowed to talk freely in Cuba.
Wow. So your first novel, The German Girl, really focused mm-hmm. on this story. Mm-hmm. Your new novel, The Daughter's Tale, I believe comes out of the response to that. A woman called Judith mm-hmm. spoke to you after the publication of that first book. Who was yes. Judith, and what did she tell you?
Yes. When I was working The German Girl, I read everything that I have access about the St. Louis. I went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. I studied over 3,000 original documents. But I didn't want to interview the survivors until I finished my novel, because I want my novel sound like a fairy tale from the point of view of a little girl. And this is the story that my grandmother passed to me. When I finished the novel, I started doing the interview, even traveling to Germany, Auschwitz, etc. And I met this beautiful old woman living in Kew Gardens, New York, in a small apartment that it looks like a stop in time. And I became, you know, I cried with her. She was 14 months old when she was in the St. Louis with her father and mother and grandfather. They were returned to Europe, and they, when sent to France, they lived happily for a couple of years in France until the Nazi arrived. And then they went to a transitional concentration camp before going to Auschwitz. She was happy there again because she was playing freely with the kids in the camp, she remember. And one night, her father took her to the forest outside the camp. He said to her, look at the tree. And at that moment, it was a couple of seconds, she never saw her father again. She was in the with the hand of another man. And the next day, her parents were sent to Auschwitz. And she lived, you know, for 5-7 years with this French family. She learned French. She had a new mother, Maman Susie, she called her. And that story, because I was writing about the Oradour-sur-Glane, this small, you know, town, village in the south of France. But I need to have like a climax for the book. And Judy gave me the climax. Yeah.
That moment where Judith's father took her into the woods and basically helped her escape, right? He said, look up at the sky. Someone else took her hand and led her away. I mean, what an incredible sacrifice for a parent to make to give their child a better life.
Exactly. And I think it was perfect for the narrative of the book that is about abandon and oblivion at the same time. When you have to abandon your son or daughter or your children because this is the only way to save them, or you have to forget to survive. And I think that decision, and in the case, it's a mother, it's not a father in the story of my book. I always admire this kind of women that are doing the impossible to save their children. I am a father, I have 3 children, and I always thinking about it when I was writing. I don't have the strength that have all these women fighting and defending the children and abandoning like the only way to save them.
So in your novel, Amanda is a Jewish woman living in Germany in the 1930s. And like you say, she is this incredibly strong woman who abandons her children in order to save them. She puts one daughter on the St. Louis off to Cuba. And then the other daughter she takes to France, where they're taken to a camp. And we see that same scene happen that you just described. Amanda sneaks her daughter out one night, tells her to look up at the stars, and then hands her over to another woman in the hope that Lena will be saved. Of course, Lena then moves to a small French village where she's about to run into history yet again. Can you tell me what happened in Oradour-sur-Glane in 1944?
Yeah, this is another kind of story like the St. Louis that we feel ashamed in a way. Oradour-sur-Glane, this small town close to Limoges, that is a big city. One day, it was a beautiful Saturday morning in the middle of the summer. The Nazi arrived. They never saw a Nazi before. All of them, they were in Limoges or in the big city. They arrived and they ordered all the people to go to the middle of the square. They put inside the church all the women and children, and they burned down the church with all of them inside. They destroy the whole town, and they kill over 640 people there. What is the reason?
Yeah, what was the motivation for that?
The motivation, it was, you know, there is a lot of stories behind that. They said because, you know, the Allies, they were coming to France sooner. There is a story about the resistance in Limoges that they killed one German officer. There was a lot of rumor. Nobody can understand why this is a small village. Some people said because the abbey, the church, they rescued a couple of children, Jewish children too. But the motivation, we don't know. And one of the reasons that I always... surprise, what is, you go to France and some people, they don't know about the story. Like the same with the St. Louis. When I remember when I presented the idea of the book in my publishing house in New York, and most of them, they were Jewish, they don't know about the St. Louis. I think it's the same case in because of the San Luis was, you know, we know Hitler killed more than 6 million Jewish, but in this case, Cuba, United States, and Canada, they were guilty too. In the case of Radaur-sur-Glane, this small town in France, yes, there were the SS, the Nazi, who ordered that massacre, but with the help of the French gendarme policemen. Even I think today there is one of these French people alive, and I'm thinking, you know, to take him to trial. That's sad. And after the war, Charles de Gaulle decided to keep Radaur-sur-Glane like a memorial. And believe me, when I went there before, right, you know, I was in the middle of the process for the research and writing the book. I went to the villa, and it's impressive the size of the town, because you see the pictures and the postcard, you feel like it's a couple of streets, one hotel, the church. No, it's huge. The dimension of the town impact me in a way that I can't describe.
Armando, there are hardly any male characters in your novel, The Daughter's Tale. It's about mothers and daughters. It's about sisters. It's about surrogate mothers, close friends. And as we've discussed, all these women who show an incredible strength that you felt that you couldn't live up to. Why tell the story of women in wartime?
I grew up with my grandmother, the crazy one, who passed the story for me of the San Luis, between my grandmother, my mother. To have an idea, my mother divorced my father when I was like 3 years old, and my sister, it was like a year during the 60s, because she wants to be an engineer. My father said, no, you have to stay at home with the children. And she decided, no, okay, I'm going to divorce you. I'm going to move to the capital. I'm going to go to the university. And I grew up with my grandmother, mother, my sister, my aunts, a strong woman trying to, you know, survive in an island. And at that moment, under the communism, you know, after a revolution, it was like a crazy time for them. And I always admired this kind of women. And my daughter is the first one that I have. I right now have two daughters and a boy. And I learned a lot from her. You know, she's a strong, young girl. And I wanted to, in the case of the German girl, it was my daughter who gave voice to Hannah and Anna in The German Girl. I was thinking all the time of her. And I think that was a continuation for The Daughter's Tale too. I admire the role of these mothers and women during the world. And in Spanish, the title is, I think, it's beautiful, and it's different in English. In English, you know, it's The Daughter's Tale. In Spanish, it's La Hija Olvidada, and the meaning is the forgotten daughter. And because the whole book is about oblivion, it's about forgetting something, and forget is really hard when you are a parent.
Yeah. Armando, you've said that The Daughter's Tale is the second in a trilogy of World War II stories, and I look forward to seeing the final novel in that series. But I wonder, are we going to see a novel from you about Cuba in the future?
I did a presentation in Canberra in the University of Australia, and one of the women from the audience asked me the same, and it's happening all the time. My mother said that I have to write, you know, a story about Cuba and this concept. I have tons of pages that I wrote about feeling claustrophobic on an island and trying to survive inside that. But I have to finish The Night Traveler. That is the end of the trilogy. I'm going back to Cuba in that book. And let's see what happened later, you know.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Armando Lucas Correa, it's been a joy to meet you, and enjoy your time here in Australia, won't you?
Oh, I love Australia. Thank you, Claire.
The Daughter's Tale is published by Simon & Schuster, and this is The Book Show on your radio and in your podcast feed. when I was growing up and reading a lot of young adult fiction, I've got to admit I loved stories about crushes, kissing, and falling in love. But just about all of those stories were heterosexual love stories. There were hardly any queer love stories that I can remember reading. Of course, today there is a much more diverse spread of young adult fiction on offer, and a new anthology brings together a collection of short stories from some of Australia's most exciting authors from the queer community. The book is called Kindred, and it features a dozen authors, including my guests. Erin Goff is the author of the YA novels The Flywheel and Amelia Westlake, while Omar Saker is a poet whose latest book is The Lost Arabs. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Erin, what was your experience like? Were you able to find a lot of queer YA to read when you were growing up?
No, I didn't read any queer, any queer content of any description until I was at university, actually. It was not something that was certainly on the syllabus of my high school or anything like that. And it wasn't something that I think I felt confident enough or sure about myself enough to kind of seek out. So unless it was something that was being recommended to me or was something that I was prescribed to read, I wasn't going to read it. And for that reason, it wasn't until I was at university that I actually was exposed to any queer content in fiction.
But that's really important because we talk about representation in books. We talk about exploring your identity. If you weren't finding those books on the shelves, what did that mean for little Erin?
a lot of confusion for many, many years, I can tell you that. Look, absolutely. I think if you are able to see a character that's like you are in certain ways, it kind of gives you permission to be yourself in the world. And if you're not able to see those characters and you're not, you're living in a community where, as I was, where I wasn't exposed or I didn't know any gay people at all either, or certainly didn't know that they were gay, then it felt very much like something that was not permissible.
And Omar, I'm guessing it might have been even harder for you to find yourself in a book growing up. You're a bisexual man, you're an Arab Australian. I can't imagine there were a lot of books about that experience on the shelves around you.
No, they really weren't.
What does it mean for a young man if you can't find those stories?
I think it exacerbates the kind of, existing conditions of being a teenager, which is that you're anxious, you're afraid. And for me, there was just a desperation, and a profound loneliness that there was no one else like me, and there was real danger in the idea of being myself.
It must feel so rewarding to be able to write those stories now and maybe offer that to another kid.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I heard you saying earlier about the financial realities of being an author in this country and in this world. It's certainly extremely difficult. But when I get messages from young Arabs and Muslims, and anyone really who is relating to my work in that way, it really gives me the motivation to continue.
Erin, what made you decide to pursue a career in writing young adult fiction? What is it that you love about this genre?
Oh, look, there are so many things to love about writing for young adults. I wrote short stories for adults for many years and continue to do so before I published my first YA novel. But I've never had the level of engagement that I have from the readership since writing YA. It is such a passionate and enthusiastic audience with so much to say and so much to share. And I feel like I learn so much from my readers. And it's an absolute honour and a pleasure to write for them.
And a privilege, I guess, because in a way you are shaping young minds. I still think that I am so much of what I read when I was about 12 years old.
Yeah, it's a bit of a responsibility in that sense as well, which can be quite scary because I do feel like there are certain books that have had such a huge impact on my view of the world and my view of writing as well. And it's those stories, I think, that you read at a formative age that do stay with you and shape who you are, absolutely.
Omar, now you're a poet by trade. Have you dabbled in YA before contributing to this anthology?
No, I have not actually written for young adults before. So that was really exciting for me because I love YA, I love fantasy, I love genre, and it's kind of what I had dreamed of being. I didn't really grow up thinking, oh, I'm going to be a poet. I don't, you know, it just wasn't part of my fantasies. It wasn't part of my ambition. But definitely, I would say this kind of work was, you know. So it took a little while. I came by an unexpected way, but yeah, I'm glad that I've started here in this particular collection, which I think is so gorgeous and full of many of my friends and fellow queer writers, and I hope to continue.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what you come up with next. And I guess you're joining this fabulous community. I know on social media there's this really, really strong representation of queer YA Australian writers. There's a couple of hashtags people can follow, Love Oz YA and Oz Queer YA. Erin, I know you're part of this community. Can you explain why it is so important for queer YA writers to connect not just with the mainstream but also to have this very kind of unique safe space to talk to each other in?
Oh, look, it's incredibly important, and it's not something that I was at all aware of until I published my first novel. And I think having done so and having connected with those people, in a sense, I feel like even though we're a virtual workplace, it's one of the most supportive workplaces I've ever had the pleasure of working in, because obviously writing is a solitary existence as it is. But when you're a queer writer, and it took me many years to, I guess, feel comfortable about exploring queer content in my fiction, it's so reassuring to see what other people are doing in that space, and having access to that support and love and friendship, because a lot of us aren't living in the same city, and it's really nice as well to, I guess, have friends across different parts of the country and different parts of the world.
I was actually just saying to someone yesterday that Twitter is sometimes not the nicest place to be, but Australian writer Twitter is a very nice place to be. Everyone's so supportive. Have you had that experience, Omar?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Erin and Omar.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. For the most part, I think Twitter.
For the most part, Twitter.
For me, yeah, it's been okay. But I mean, I feel like I've probably blocked and muted so many people that it's, you know, it's taken a while for it to.
You've created a safe space.
Yeah, I have, you know, and I'm okay with that. So. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just talk to nice people. That's what I try to do.
Yeah. Yeah,
now, I'd love to get into the stories that you have both written for this book. They both deal with exciting new secret relationships. They both also involve kissing behind curtains. I don't know if you've both identified that. But the emotions are quite different. Omar, maybe we can start with you. Your story is called An Arab Werewolf in Liverpool. That's the suburb of Sydney, and we meet Wafat. He's reconnected with a very handsome old friend, Noah, and there's a bit going on there. What's happening with Wafat?
Oh, my goodness. So much. he's kind of coming into an awareness of his body and his sexuality, and it's kind of seeing Noah or Nuh after a long time is kind of the catalyst for him not necessarily in a good way. It's a catalyst in the sense that it brings forward all the kind of negative or things that he's heard about and that thus associated with his sexuality, and how that kind of makes a monster of his body. So, and that's kind of prompts the shift into werewolf. And then him learning to accept that and appreciate also the power of it.
The timing of this story is interesting because it's set at Ramadan. So he's hungry.
Yeah, look, I think
hungry for food, hungry for attention, hungry for love.
Yeah, I Yes. I think, yeah, Ramadan is a very kind of, it's a very sensitive time. It's a very complex time for me. And it's one that I associate with both scarcity and abundance, right? So you're fasting during the day and then you're feasting at night. And so I was also kind of using that metaphor in this story because that can, it has, again, there are positive and negative connotations to that. So you can, because you're so hungry when you have this food in front of you, you can kind of make yourself sick if you go too fast, too hard. You know what I mean? There's a danger in that kind of, in that feasting when you've been starving for so long.
Yeah, it's a great story. Erin, as you. I said, your story also involves kissing behind curtains, but it's very different. It's called In Case of Emergency. We meet Amy. She is a student. She's working for a catering company and she's a bit bored with kissing her boyfriend, Stephen. She's not sure why it's so boring.
That's right. Stephen's a lovely guy, and he seems to tick all the right boxes, and yet she has this intense boredom with the entire relationship. And I guess that comes somewhat out of personal experience. I went through a phase in my early teenage and later teenage years where I really gave it a good shot dating boys. I tried very hard, and I think it was difficult to work out for me what was going on because they were lovely. They were really nice and we had a nice time, great conversationalist, very good looking. But it was, you know, then I kissed a girl and that was the end of that.
It was all over.
It was all over.
And that's what happens. We do meet this mysterious Red. She's hiding behind a curtain in a mansion and she's a kind of otherworldly almost character, I found.
Yeah, she is. And it's one of those moments, and I guess this is where my story gets a little bit into magic realist elements, in that it is such a transformative experience for Amy that things start happening in the world around her. So people start speaking in rhyme, the world floods, humans gain the power of flight. And I guess I wanted to use those elements to explore that transformation, that moment where you actually have the experience of being with somebody you're intensely attracted to and how that can change your life.
Yeah, it's interesting that both of you have kind of gone for this almost magical experience around these first kisses, these first moments of love.
I think that's pretty common, right, for queer writing, maybe in particular, the notion of transformation after it's, you know, I liken it to a personal apocalypse. It's like it's the end of a world,
like a good one.
And yes, it's the end of a world and the beginning of another. So.
Of a beautiful new world. Well, I have enjoyed exploring the worlds in this book. Erin and Omar, thanks to you both so much for coming into the studios.
Thank you.
Erin Goff and Omar Saker are two of the authors from Kindred, 12 Queer Love Oz YA Stories, a new Australian anthology edited by Michael Earp and published by Walker Books. And thanks so much for joining me on the book show today. It's been an absolute pleasure to be with you once again. Thanks to the team behind this week's show. Skye Kirkham is our acting EP. Our technical producer is Angie Grant. And I want to say a huge thanks to Alice Walker, who has been producing this show while Sarah Lestrange has been working on another project. Alice, it has been such good fun. Thank you so much. I'm Claire Nichols. I'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.